Welcome to another temporal time episode of the Atomic Powered Supercast with your hosts, Sandra, David, and Jen. This week, our topic is Days of Future Past by Chris Claremont. The cast starts as soon.
Okay, everybody, welcome to another Dumb Cluck episode of the Atomic Powered Supercast. My name is Andy, and I'm hanging out with David.
Hey.
And Jen.
Hey.
You know, I saw that in the notes, and I can't remember where that appeared.
Somebody did something stupid, and Warren Worthington III called him a dumb cluck, and I'm like, wow, that's really...
It's not very well concealed. I think that was in one of the Wendigo issues.
I think you're right. So. That was really not very well concealed.
Like, it's all the better.
Yes. So anyway, this week we read X-Men Days of Future Past. It collects Uncanny X-Men number 138 to 143 from 1980 and X-Men Annual number 4, but I didn't read X-Men Annual. Did you guys?
No, I couldn't find it on Marvel's digital
thing. Yeah, me either. So this was by Chris Claremont and John Byrne. And what's cool is, I didn't realize this until I looked up and did notes, but our first comic that we read was Dark Phoenix. Like, the very first show we did was Dark Phoenix. And this comes, right after that.
Yeah, because I think the last Dark Phoenix issue is 137.
You know, and I'm really good that we didn't read this one back then, because issue 138, the whole remembering exposition of the entire history of the X-Men.
That you just read.
Jesus.
It was like a clip show.
It was worse than the clip show, though.
Because you had to read it?
But it was, yes, because it required work.
It was so many words. I would actually, it kind of set the tone for the whole trade for me. And made me not actually read everything. And this is the first time I've ever done that with anything ever. I don't skim things, but for today's comic, I mostly skimmed it and looked at the pictures and was like, eh, okay.
You know, I read, so when I looked up what to read, I only read 141 and 142. Because if you Google Days of the Future Past, that's what comes up. It's just those two issues. And then I looked at the notes and I was like, oh crap, I have to read these other things too. And so then, Jen, I started reading the first 138 and I was like, oh my god. So I started skimming it. And then I kind of read the Wendigo ones. And then the Christmas special one at the end, I was like, whatever.
Yeah.
So when I rate this at the end, I'm mostly going to rate
141 and 142. You know what gets me though? It's if you're going to do a retrospective, this is the perfect place to do it, right? Because it's Scott Summers looking back on his career as an X-Man from the very first issue of the comic. Since their existence, he's been an X-Man, you know? And, this is him leaving the team. This is his family, and he's electively leaving it. This is a serious, brutal, big moment in this guy's life. And it makes sense that he would take a moment after his wife fucking died to look back on his career and his life and evaluate what he wants to get from his life. The problem is it doesn't feel like that, you know? Because at the end of this giant exposition of his memory, there's no, sense of a reason why he's leaving other than, it's time. We got new people. My wife's dead. Fuck it. You know? There's no sense of, I feel this need to move on. I don't want to put the next person I love into this position. It's not worth it for me anymore. This is a very strenuous, torturous life. There's a new crop, and I'm not needed. There's none of that. It's just, well, all that happened. Later.
Yeah, you know...
go ahead, sorry.
Oh, it makes sense for him to look back and reflect on what happened. It doesn't make sense for me to have to do it, because I just read it, because this is issue 138, which came after 137, where all this happened. And I feel like it was one of those, lazy, let's use flashbacks issues, except they didn't really do that to any purpose. So we ended up with a bunch of repetitive crap that was boring and didn't explain or develop character.
Yeah.
Well, I think it's a good... I think 139 is a good issue to join X-Men if you hadn't been reading it. Because it's like kind of a new team. We kind of get reintroduced to everybody that's on the current team because we see, like, you know, we see Angel and Wolverine, Nightcrawler, Colossus, Kitty Pryde, and Storm.
Yeah.
And they're, like, the core team for a while now. But, you know, like you said, the part before it was just a clip show, and it didn't have much substance. And like you said, Andy, it was like, blah, blah, blah. Magneto got beat up, and then we fought a different guy. And then we fought Magneto again, and we beat him again. And then we fought another different guy, and then we fought Magneto again. Except this time, Magneto was also on our side. Right?
Yeah.
And then so... And then Scott's like, all right, everybody, remember all those things we did? Okay, bye.
Yeah, seriously, reading this, I didn't get anything out of this about Scott Summers' character. I didn't get anything out of this about the team or anything. The only thing that I really took away from this is, man, I really pity Magneto.
Well, the thing, too, is like...
Like, in anime, it's all about the power of... Because I've been watching more anime than I should for somebody who purports not like anime. But, like, it's all about the power of heart and determination. If it really were, Magneto would totally be winning right now. Because he keeps getting kicked and back up and kicked and back up.
Well, like, another thing, too, is in the flashback, we meet a lot of characters. We meet Beast and Iceman, Jean Grey and Cyclops, right?
Yeah.
If you jumped in starting at issue 138 and then read 139, you'd be like, okay, the only person I know that Cyclops and Jean Grey, I know their backstory, but what about this Ice guy and the Agility guy? They just disappeared.
Yeah.
Did maybe I missed it in my skimming, but...
Cause no, they never explained it.
Yeah, they're just gone.
Well, they made it the same thing Cyclops did. Said, fuck it, I'm going to get on a boat.
They just weren't important enough to,
They didn't get their own... Yeah, they didn't get their own clip show.
They should have, like, a reunion issue, like, at the end of a reality show where all the stars get together and talk about it.
He said something about how, like, they got injured or left or something. Like, he kind of mentioned, oh, it was sad, but he never actually explained the circumstances of their departure.
You know what, though? That was the other thing that was... When you put it all down on a single issue like this, it felt really ridiculous because it was like, oh, and then he died, but not really. And then he died, and this guy died, but not really there either. And then this guy died, but it was another deception. And it's like, holy God, comics are horrible. It really made me question the whole medium to read it all happen in one issue. It's like, you people are fucking dumb.
The history of comics.
Why do you trust anybody?
If our podcast ever gets quoted by some major media outlet, they're going to pull that quote. The holy God, comics are horrible.
Hey. So, okay, we should move away from this issue.
It's hot. Yeah. Wendigo.
Yes. So, was Wendigo redeeming at all?
It was stupid.
You know, this trade is supposed to be one of the best comics of all time, right, guys?
Well, no. Days of the Future Past storyline is.
Okay, just those two issues.
Wendigo was... I mean, I don't know. I feel like Wendigo is setting... not Wendigo, but like stuff that happens in these issues is kind of setting us up for something. Mm-hmm. And we're kind of learning about these... We're meeting these characters, right?
Yeah.
But it's like... I don't know. It was just not that good.
Well, you're right. I think it's a good... You can't throw them straight into Days of Future Past, right? Because if you do that, then you see them dying like you're supposed to have some kind of attachment to them, except you don't. So you have to send them somewhere else first. Except the Wendigo stuff is all just Wolverine and Nightcrawler and Alpha Flight, who you also don't give a fuck about because they're Canadian.
Aw, sorry, Canadian listeners. Andy really doesn't mean that.
Alpha Flight was awesome. They had, like...
You really liked Alpha Flight?
They were stupid, too. The princess like Mountie who turn into Wolverines and bears, and then Doctor like two young guys or something. What's his name?
That's his name. That's his last name.
Who named him? It was a terrible decision.
But it's like, you know how in...
You know he's gay, right?
No, he's not. Is he?
He's not North Star. He's Shaman.
Oh, Shaman. Sorry. No, yeah. The other one is gay.
Yeah, or North Star's gay.
We never saw him.
But he got mentioned in a word bubble.
Wait, he's not the one in the red suit?
No, that's Vindicator.
Oh. I don't know. Somebody with a Canadian outfit on.
Well, yeah.
North gay in comics. That's all I know about.
Black star on his suit or something, not a red one.
Okay. I think, well, anyways.
Well, I'm very confused.
Aren't him and his sister Aurora kind of like the Wonder Twins, where like they hold hands and get powers?
I think so. Something like that. Also, it's implied that Wolverine was actually like kind of on Alpha Flight.
We're supposed to have run it?
He was.
Yeah, like that is not a thing I knew about him.
Me either. And
that's Canadian.
Well, it's kind of neat because I honestly, in a world where there's so much inundation of Wolverine, I've gone out of my way to not read stuff with him in it because I feel like I see him on the covers everywhere. And he's the dude that everybody's supposed to like. So I went out of my way to not know things about him. And it was kind of cool, actually, to get his backstory when he was new to comics.
See, I feel like you're shooting yourself in the foot there, Andy, because there is good Wolverine stuff. It's just that he's like... There is stuff that's like not that good, but there's a lot of really good stuff. There's a reason why he's really popular, right?
Yeah, and after these issues, I did like him here. I like the thought of, like, how he didn't want to be the leader of Alpha Flight. He wanted a different opportunity somewhere else because he didn't like that his life was going in that direction. He didn't want to keep up the job. He didn't want to keep up the role of just being somebody who kills and is really good at killing. He didn't want to do that anymore. And even though he still has that instinct, he actively tried to move his life away from that direction and went to Charles Xavier knowing that it would happen there and not an Alpha Flight. And I really thought that was cool.
Yeah, he was actually pretty well fleshed out in this. And his relationship with the other team members, too, and his relationship with Alpha Flight kind of developed his character well, even though it was a really goofy storyline. Like, the way he and Nightcrawler kind of had this sweet bro thing going where they watched out for each other and were also bickering a lot.
Yes. They were a very cute couple.
Yeah.
So, was there anything else worth talking about with the Wendigo stuff? I don't know. I kind of
So, the other thing is, like, I thought... Well, it's not the Wendigo stuff, but it's the, like, side things that are happening to the other X-Men.
Mm-hmm.
There was the story with Storm and Kitty Pryde going to the dance studio.
Oh, yeah.
I just thought it was funny where... Well, I mean, hopefully... Maybe I'll read some more issues of this, but I want to know why Storm was creeped out by the dance instructor.
I know. I couldn't figure that out at all. While, like, she was creeped out or, like, jealous of the bond that they were forming... It felt really weird.
Well, it seems like she was jealous because she says, "our kitten." Like, she's surprised when she says that. But even before that line, she says she gets a weird vibe from the teacher.
Maybe she's evil. We just don't know it yet.
Yeah, but...
God, I hope there's an evil dance instructor.
She's top five.
Like Dazzler's nemesis or something.
So okay, do we want to talk about? But that's just okay. After the Wendigo stuff, we'll actually talk about the Days of Future Past 2 issues. So I don't know if I like these or not. I do. I know I like them, but after I read these, I wasn't like, oh man, these were fucking amazing. The way I was after I read the Dark Phoenix stuff, and I finished reading, and I was like, wow, this was really fucking cool. I read this, and I was like, hey, that was neat. That was a comic. I don't know, I didn't get that same feeling from this that I did from Dark Phoenix.
I think it was meant to be, like, really dark and moving and reflective of that whole deeper X-Men theme that we get of what bigotry can do to destroy people. But there were no, long-term consequences. It wasn't actually resolved because even though they thwarted the assassination, he was later like, well, even though the X-Men saved my life, those other evil mutants who call themselves the Brotherhood of Evil Mutants tried to kill me, so let's draft some legislation against mutants. And then Kitty Pryde doesn't even remember anything, so in the end, Charles Xavier is the only person who actually knows what went down, and he's not going to tell anyone.
Yeah.
So we're kind of back at square one after two issues, and that, I think, reduces the impact because no one is left changed by it.
Yes. I mean, okay, so when I finished reading this, I had two conflicting thoughts. My first was like, okay, so I know they offhandedly mentioned, and like they had a single frame with a bunch of faces and X on it explaining why like Thor and Iron Man and Captain America aren't there. Apparently they got hunted down too.
Yes.
But like this whole time I was thinking, man, if this was the future and they did something, they pitched something like this nowadays and they printed it, it would be like a big event where like they would show where everybody was in the future. It would be like this year-long story arc. It'd be fucking crazy.
Crossover with every comic.
Exactly. And I was thinking, man, thank God this is like just an X-Men story. That's so cool. I like that. And then I was at the end, I was like, wow. I really wish I would have gotten more information about where the fuck everybody else was and everything else that was going on. Why the world went to shit. Like, tell me some reason why this matters other than everybody dies. But not really, maybe? They're undead? Or it's another universe, like a separate timeline now? Because Kate Pryde, right, in the future pointed out, she was like, hey, maybe we do all this and it just creates another alternate reality that we don't actually know about.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
Super depressing.
Yeah.
Like, well, that was kind of in vain.
What about you, David? What do you think about the two issues, the 141 and 142?
I don't know. You know what's funny is, so my first experience with Days of the Future Past is actually from the X-Men cartoon. Do you guys remember those episodes?
No, not those.
Not
so one. It's completely different. So instead of Kitty Pryde and like mind switch things, they basically send Bishop back in time, and he goes and stops the assassin. And it's still Mystique, and it's still that. But you know, you know, like you said, this is supposed to be one of the best X-Men comics ever, and I kind of feel like I like the cartoon version better. But I think like you
said, what's interesting, if you actually look this up, there's a lot more information about the cartoon one than the comic itself.
So
I almost feel like it could have been the cartoon that got such renown.
Well, if you think like the cartoons over like three or four episodes, and this was two issues, and they kind of do it in a different way. So instead of, I mean, it's the same good deal, like the future's still the same in both. Except instead of Rachel Summers having to use her psychic powers to switch the minds, they basically send Bishop back in time. Do you guys remember Bishop? He's a mutant.
Yeah.
And so he goes back in time to X-Men's current timeline, and he can't remember why he got sent back in time, and so he has to kind of piece it together with Professor Xavier's help. And he remembers that there's an assassin that he has to stop, and it's one of the X-Men. And so he goes and, you know, they go to Washington, and they're all, and the Brotherhood of Evil Mutants are there, led by Mystique again. And what it turns out is that it's Mystique, but she's shapeshifted to look like Gambit. And so now both Gambit and her fight, and they end up saving Senator Kelly, but it's the same kind of thing where, well, it is kind of different because Senator Kelly kind of says, you know, we do need to think about what we're going to do about all these mutants popping up, but the Sentinels are the wrong idea. And what ends up happening is it spins out into another storyline where Master Mold's like out of control.
But at least it gives definitive closure.
Yeah. They definitely erase that timeline. But it's weird because, no, they do, I can't remember, I think Bishop ends up getting sent back because he has like this bracelet that keeps him from being pulled back to his own time, and I think it gets broken. So we don't really know what happens to Bishop.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a whole thing where they try to stop the Sentinels.
Okay.
Of course, it doesn't work because the Sentinels are always around, but
yeah.
They try. They kind of give closure on the Sentinels in that they defeat Master Mold at the end of it, but in the subsequent episode, the Sentinels are back because the guys who created them are still alive. But, you know, like you said, there's kind of... It's long, and it kind of is two story arcs that are combined, but... You know, you get the time-traveling part, and then you stop the assassination, and then the target kind of recants, and they try to stop the Sentinels from becoming a thing, and then they realize, oh, it's too late, so the X-Men have to go fight the Sentinels, and it felt like a story that had more, like, it mattered more to the overall storyline of the X-Men cartoon.
Yeah.
Where here, we, you know, some bad things happen. We don't really know... It doesn't matter, right? Not at this point.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that what ends up happening is that alternate future gets designated as Earth 800 something. Like, it becomes an alternate Earth that they plunder again for more stories in the future because it was popular. But I'm pretty sure what ends up happening is it just creates another... It's just like a separate timeline where it actually was... The assassination attempt was successful.
Oh, yeah, you're right. So...
That's my understanding about the comics. But then... That's the downside of multiple realities within your comic book universe, is that if anything really cool happens and you want to keep it, but you want to resolve it so it doesn't actually happen, you can just say, oh, it was a different reality. There wasn't Earth 616. That was Earth 811. Whatevs.
But what Marvel has established is that time travel can result in multiple timelines that are become multiple dimensions. So it's like a recurring thing in Marvel. It's not like a new thing. That's how, because I think like they can have like the Cable timeline, and when Cable comes back and like does his thing and supposedly wins, he doesn't get erased from
existence.
Exactly.
Yeah. So, okay. I mean, we've talked about some of the faults, but I want to say I did like a lot of the feel of this comic. I think the art was really good about making it feel dystopian. And I love the little details, like the different designations, like human. There was like human, kind of human, and mutant, right? And like the three different classifications and the how they were worn. Even if you were human, you still had to wear it, you know. And I like that there was subtle stuff too, like when Kate Pride, because she's a grown up woman now, was on like the bus that was being drawn by horses, and like it was just in the background, but you know, everybody in that horse drawn bus was pointing at her and staring. And it's like, it's not immediately in the narrative. She doesn't mention it. You know, it's never mentioned. She doesn't look back at them, and they blend in, you know, they don't blend in with the background, but they're obviously not the foreground part of the picture. And it's just little details like that that I thought were really neat about making it feel dystopian for mutants.
Well, it's dystopian for everybody. Oh, yeah. Even normal humans, it seems like it sucks pretty hard to live there. But I get what you're saying.
Were there any, like, what did you guys like about, I mean, we've talked about the things that we didn't like so far. What did you guys like about this? I mean, there has to be a reason it's one of the best comics of all time.
I mean, it's a good story. I think maybe we're a little bit jaded because, like you said, Andy, we get these huge crossovers where every, like, 9 people die, and then it results in stories of how we're going to make those people come back. And in this, it just, I mean, it's a good, solid story. It's interesting, you know. It talks about, like, what you said about how there's one of the key themes in X-Men is tolerance and prejudice, and how that prejudice could manifest in crazy ways, because this is a crazy world where people have superpowers and there's giant robots and stuff. It kind of takes things to the extreme, right? But it's still an important message, and it's like, look, if you take this prejudice too far, we get things like internment camps and people being you know, people are having their civil rights taken away. So, you know, it's a good X-Men story in that it really talks about, in two issues, we get what X-Men is about, you know?
Yeah.
We get that there's, you know, there's this group of people who are, for whatever reason, you know, marginalized, we'll say. And then there's the people, there's the two factions within that group, those who want to improve their situation through peaceful coexistence, which is, you know, the X-Men. And then we get the Brotherhood of Evil Mutants who just want to do their evil thing and just take over using their superior abilities. And then, you know, so like I said, I feel like it's a good representation of X-Men in just two issues.
Yeah, and I think it's the one thing that really made me, like, when I was reading this, go, oh man, I want to talk about that, was Magneto in the wheelchair.
Yeah.
That felt really, like, a juicy topic to me. Juicy was the best word I could come up with. Because here we actually do see what happens when Magneto wins, right? I mean, we talk about how 138 was crappy, but I think the reason you read 138 is because it's repetition. Magneto loses, Magneto loses, Magneto loses, and the world is still relatively okay. We get a new crop of X-Men, and I get to retire. Right? Like, I get to retire from being a superhero because there's so much good stuff going on and working. And this is what happens if that one time they don't win. If that one time they fail, Magneto succeeds in assassinating this dude, and then the world falls to a friggin' horde of Sentinels. And the irony is that he becomes subjugated by this world that he's crafted, in part.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, there's quite the reversal. He was acting in the role of Charles Xavier pretty much exactly. He was mentoring them. He sacrificed himself for their safety in the end. He was clearly, like, a major father figure to the group.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of, I think it kind of underlines that theme, like, oh, we're all the same, which I think is what they're trying to always push for in X-Men, you know, these strange people. They're so different, but they're the same. They're people.
Well, that's the one interesting thing about, one thing that I like the most about the Professor Xavier and Magneto relationship is that, you know, they both want the same thing. They want mutants to be accepted in one way or another, and they go about it in very different ways, which is kind of almost the same way, actually, because they both end up fighting all the time, but, you know, mm-hmm. Details.
So through this story, who are your favorite characters here? I mean, we can't talk about a team without talking about favorite characters.
Definitely Kitty Pryde and Kate Pryde, you know, both versions of her. Because the older version was capable and, you know, really quick on her feet thinking about what she needed to do to make things work in the situation. Like when she was like, wait, I need to protect the senator. Or when she was like, I knew that convincing Storm would be the hardest part, and then she just does it really quickly. And then Kitty Pryde, and especially, I know like 143 isn't quite part of
Christmas
this, but
special.
Dude, she was pretty awesome in the Christmas special. And we could talk about that like in a bit, but
yeah,
Kitty Pryde's definitely my favorite one in this trade.
What about you, David?
It's hard to say because Kitty's like clearly the central character in this.
Yeah.
Everybody else is kind of tertiary or secondary. I don't know. It's I guess I want to say I liked Kitty a lot, too. If I had to pick somebody else, since Jen already talked about her.
You can pick Kitty, because
I'll go with, I really like Nightcrawler.
Yeah.
You know, he's, I feel like he's one of the most capable and powerful X-Men. But he's, like, so, he's definitely does not act the way that he appears, right? He's the definition of appearances can be deceiving, because he's like such a gentle guy, and we get that here because he realizes that his appearance, I guess you could say, frightens Kitty a little bit, but he's so he wants to be her friend so much that he's like, well, I'll just keep trying. She'll come around eventually. He doesn't want to force anything.
He fucking brings them lemonade, right? And he likes them all so much, and he wants them all to like him so much that he remembers to bring Wolverine a beer instead of a lemonade, because Wolverine's a man, right? Like,
that's he's gritty.
Like, that scene defined Kurt Wagner's character for me. Like, yeah, he can just teleport in and out of whatever problem he's in. You know, he's agile, he's smart, he's cunning, he's all these great things. Fuck it, bring a lemonade. That's going to be what I do today.
Yeah.
I got to say, my favorite, hands down, was Colossus. I haven't read a whole lot of stuff with Colossus in it, but to me, whenever I was reading this, he had the best lines. Like, when he's talking about his love for working the land, like, that was awesome. But my favorite to me was in the future, right? You know, and he's talking with Kate Pryde, you know, and Kate says, well, what does the love of these two people matter against the lives of billions? And he just says in two sentences, I'm selfish. It matters to me. Like, that's, I love that line, because so many times in comics and movies, you don't get that kind of a thing. You don't get that insight, and like, the characters hardly ever have that self-consciousness. Like, he knows he's being selfish. He sees it. Mm-hmm. But he's being selfish because, really, that's what matters to him. He doesn't give a fuck about the other billions of people on the planet. It mattered. This is the one person that matters to him, and fuck everybody else, they can all die. But in saying that, he also realizes that he's being selfish. He realizes he's not necessarily being, you know, like, in every movie and TV show where they play it off as being romantic. No, you're a selfish dick. There are 5.9 billion people who are going to die. You're a selfish asshole. But, like, by having that insight into his own self, like, that made me love him. Those two sentences made me love Colossus so much. So, yeah, definitely Colossus. So, should we talk about the resolution of the story? Was it satisfying at all for you guys? Because I gotta say, when they came in and they announced to everyone, we are the Brotherhood of Evil Mutants, I was I put it in the notes. I mean, really, if you call yourself the Brotherhood of Evil Mutants, do you honestly believe that you're in the ideological right?
Yeah, it's too bad nobody had a mustache to twirl or something, right?
Yeah. Mystique could have one.
Oh yeah, she could have grown a mustache.
Oh, yeah, she could have. And I think, who was it that put in, Mystique also characterizes them as menace incarnate? I didn't even catch that.
Yeah, I actually kind of had a slight counter. I mean, yeah, they're evil, but I'm pretty sure, like, her whole shtick, Mystique's thing, is to be evil to normal humans, because they're trying to do this to show the superiority of mutants. I think Kate Pryde says that pretty early into the story, and it backfires, but I'm pretty sure that they're pretty okay with evil and superior coinciding as their ideology.
Yeah, I think you're right. They wanted to, like, instead of, they wanted to rule through fear and have people cower before them, but instead people formed a mob and chased them with torches and then made giant robots.
So we get two resolutions, right? We get the one resolution with the Brotherhood of Evil Mutants in the 1980s, right? Where they kind of thwart the killing and they kind of thwart what's going to happen, but it ends up happening anyway because, you know, fate is a cruel mistress or whatever. And then we have the future where, as the cover says, this issue, everybody dies. We're just, everybody dies.
Well, I mean, everybody did die, technically.
Yeah, and actually, I really did like that resolution of that. I really did like the end of the future storyline, because, really, you all should die. There's no way the three of them should be able to infiltrate the Baxter building and then, like, at the same time, defeat the Sentinels, save the world, have Kitty Pryde come back, make the future work, make the past work. Like, it would have been too perfect. Some of them have to die. And at the same time, I like the way that the Sentinels were condescending dicks. Like, the Omega Sentinel was like, you believed you could breach our inner sanctum unnoticed? And I was sitting there like, Yeah, they took the fucking elevator. Like, they weren't even trying to be sneaky. They just got into the ground floor. They picked a lock, got into the ground floor, didn't even try to avoid cameras or anything, and just got in the elevator and said, go to the control level. And then they just sat in the elevator until it got up there.
It kind of makes you wonder if they just knew it was a suicide mission.
Yeah, that's the point, too. Like, if they're just trying to buy time, purposefully.
Because, I mean, they have the telepath guard Kitty while she's unconscious, and they go up there, and it almost seems like they're just buying time.
Yeah, I hadn't thought about that. That makes sense.
But, you know, if their whole point of their mission was to change the past and it all rested on Kate / Kitty succeeding, couldn't they just have, like, hung out in the prison?
I mean, yeah.
Maybe I just don't remember why they needed to escape.
Yeah, you know,
maybe
I'm not...
they just wanted to escape because it sucked there, which is a good enough reason, too.
Oh, I think it was because the Sentinels realized that they had broken the collar restraints.
Oh, right, that's right, because, yeah, her powers.
And, Wolverine at one point says, you know, they expect us to go up and join the Canadian Resistance, but... they don't expect us to do a full frontal assault. So maybe it's kind of catching them off guard and buying more time. I don't know.
Yeah,
there's got to be a, like, okay, I know it's leveled. I know it's destroyed and it's dystopia, but there's got to be some part of New York City where you can hide, right? There has to be some abandoned, you know, like, subway station with four mutated turtles in it or something that you could hang out in and fucking hide for, you know, 3 hours. It was a little weird, but the distracting suicide mission seems to explain it for me sufficiently. I'll go back and put that in my head.
I mean, keep in mind, Wolverine was the one who planned this.
That's true.
So
Wolverine would never think to hide. That would never be his plan. So then the other storyline is the one with Destiny shooting. And you know what? I like that it was Destiny, because I honestly didn't see it coming that she would be the one who would be trying to do the assassination.
Yeah.
I didn't see that. As they're, like, rounding them up one by one, I'm like, okay, wait, but then which one of them was supposed to be doing the assassination? Because this fight was supposed to happen. This fight would have happened.
Mm-hmm.
Either way. So during this fight, somebody goes unnoticed and somebody commits the assassination during this fight. And I was sitting the whole time like, who the fuck isn't here? Pyro's here? Blob is here? And I had completely forgotten about Destiny.
Because she seems like such a non-threatening character. I mean, she's just a blind clairvoyant, right?
Yeah. Old woman. But yeah, I like... And then when it shows you her there, it makes sense. You know? It's like... Of course, you wouldn't do Pyro because Pyro could be bot because he's a douchebag, right? You wouldn't do Blob because he's a fucking idiot and he would screw it up somehow. You know, Mystique wouldn't do it herself because she wants to be out there leading the charge. And Mystique is also all about self-preservation. She knows if she gets caught doing that, she's stuck. There's mm-hmm. no way out. If she's out in the fray, she can pretend she's a fucking police officer and screw the hell off. Right? Like, it all makes sense once you see it. But the whole time the fight's happening, I didn't see it coming, and I really did like that resolution a lot.
Yeah, but what about, like, the end resolution where the senator's still like, yep, gotta ban mutants? What did you think of that?
Yeah, what did you think about it?
I thought it was awful. It was like, he is clearly on the fence about it. And it struck me as really, especially considering the speech he gave at the beginning, really poorly thought out on his part, that he would be in favor of tracking down mutants in the end. Because at the start he was kind of like, well, mutants do these bad things, they also do good things, they're like people. And then after he's attacked, he's like, they're not like people, they attacked me. And then someone points out the X-Men saved him, and he's like... Yeah, but they wouldn't have had to if the other mutants weren't there. And it's like, your logic is really bad, guy.
I mean, it kind of reminds me of the Lex Luthor Superman logic of, if you weren't here, we could totally progress on our own, but you stop us from progressing. It's the same kind of circular non-logic that only a weird mind can perpetuate on its own.
Yeah, and it just makes it really sad because it's kind of like, well, why did all the future X-Men go and get killed if this is the end result? It didn't even fix anything in the 1980 timeline.
Yeah, so in the end, it was all for nothing. Right? Because even though they did succeed, and even though they sent Kate Pryde back, and even though Kate Pryde did prevent the assassination, that wasn't... It's an error in judgment, right? It's the whole hindsight thing. Like, you look back and you see this incident, and then you see this happen, and you see the correlation, but it turns out that incident wasn't actually the linchpin. You know, maybe what they need to go back is fucking, like, go back and murder Sebastian Shaw, maybe. If and at all possible.
You know what strikes me as odd now? Why didn't Kate Pryde go back in time and talk to someone in legislation and be like, hey, I'm from the future. You can ask Charles Xavier over here. You trust him. And if you go and build robots to hunt down and kill all the mutants, Europe is going to go nuclear on your ass. So don't do it, because it will kill everybody. Like, no one ever thought to do that. It was more like, let's stop this assassination and hope it does something.
Well, yeah, because talking doesn't make for a good comic.
Can.
Okay. So let's see. What else? I guess then all we have left is the Christmas issue.
Yeah.
Did anybody care about the Christmas issue?
The beginning made no sense, and I don't know what was happening. I feel like maybe I was missing pages.
I know. I think it was. Remember when the X-Men fought these guys? Okay, one of these guys got free. We didn't actually get them all. One of them got free. But yeah, if you didn't remember when they fought these guys, it was just like a 2-second recap of previously on that you didn't see the previously on.
Yeah,
it was like Storm fighting them, and then she destroys the cairn, and then it's like, oh, the seasons pass, but then she feels her mind getting sucked into it, and then there's demons and some, I don't know. Kitty Pryde was cool. She fared really well in that comic.
Yeah, in the end, Professor Xavier is a horrible caretaker, leaving a 13-year-old girl unattended in a mansion full of really expensive, really dangerous, really deadly things that's also the target of half of the villains on the planet, but left her there alone to have a Hanukkah surprise on Christmas. Really, he's a horrible caretaker, and the fact that everybody went along with it means that none of them have children. None of them have ever had children.
Well, they haven't. They're all children themselves, Andy.
Keep in mind, he is like a creepy old bald dude who'll show up at your doorstep and be like, I see that little Susie is a very special girl. You should let her come live with me in my mansion.
I'm here for your children.
He's like the king pedophile.
Aww.
He's creepy.
That's not fair to Chuck.
Chuck. Oh, that was a good scene. I did like that scene.
Yeah. Don't call me Charlie. Okay, Chuck.
Wolverine's a rebel.
That's right.
Since when did Wolverine have a hick accent? Did you notice that? Did it seem weird?
Well, I don't remember. Maybe he's a Canadian cowboy.
It was weird.
Well, do we got anything more to say?
Yeah. Oh.
Yes? Go.
Okay. So, the actual writing, the prose.
Yes.
Really was it killed some stuff for me, and I kind of want to talk about it. And I'm just going to cite one instance that kind of colored the whole comic, where when Kate Pryde goes to the past, and they're saying, like, oh, she's really different. Wolverine is citing the reasons, and he goes, she smells like a woman. Like, okay. But I think that's a really funny line. It also is representative of some really purple prose in this. And did you guys notice that? Did it bother you at all? Or did it just kind of, like, turn into, oh, 80s comics?
Yeah, I think I kind of just chalked it up to being the style.
Yeah, I did see that, and I was like, that's a little weird. And then I remembered, like, Kitty Pryde is probably, I mean, this is, I'm going to get freaky sex talk here, but Kitty Pryde, strictly speaking, is prepubescent or early puberty, right? And Kate Pryde will have definitely been beyond that point. And through that development, if you believe that Wolverine has a good enough nose to smell hormone balances in a person's body, like he can identify a person by their scent and not just their smell. Like, if you believe that he can smell pheromones and hormone changes and that sort of thing, like, the hormone balance of an adult woman is very, very different from the hormone balance of a 13-and-a-half-year-old girl. And so if you really want to retcon and rationalize it in your head and work hard to not make it creepy the way I did, you could kind of think that.
That's kind of a stretch,
I'd say. It is kind of a stretch. It's definitely a stretch.
Yeah. Because
I thought you were going to go one way, Andy, and then you went a different way, and I was relieved.
That makes me wonder what you think of me.
I've known you for a long time.
Wait, what the fuck? I've known you for a long time. I totally expected you to go the weird, stupid, freaky way. probably right. Yeah, I mean, there were points like that. There were a lot of points where I think the writing was strong and where it was weak. I mean, I don't feel like this was as solid as some other stuff, like, you know, Dark Phoenix, per se.
Well, here, how about this, Jen? I agree with you that the prose is weak, but I think Chris Claremont's ability to tell story is very good.
That's a pretty fair assessment, I would say.
Okay. Speaking of fair assessments, I think we're ready to rate this. This is going to be interesting. I'm really curious what one of you named Jen will say.
Hey, I was hoping you wouldn't ask me first, because I honestly don't know. This had a lot of... This was a bit sporadic in terms of quality, I would say. And I do want to point out, like, when I say things that sound really harsh, like, oh, the Wendigo plot's stupid. It's stupid, but in a delightful way. Yeah. I mean, they're in Canada with Alpha Flight fighting a Yeti. How awesome does that get?
With girl Beast Boy.
Two young men.
Snowbird's cool.
Hey, Beast Boy is cool. We need to read some Teen Titans up in this bitch. Beast Boy is cool. I will defend that guy.
I mean...
I don't know. I don't know where that anger came from. I'll cut you. You talk bad about Teen Titans, I will cut you.
Okay, so apparently no shit-talking about Alpha Flight. But this comic was... It was a mixed bag, certainly. The trade grouping makes sense chronologically, like, of course. Thematically, not so much, because it's really, really hard to shift from Yeti wrestling to Holocaust apocalypse future dystopia.
Yeah.
So, well, that's life of the X-Men, Jen.
True. I mean... I guess I'm glad I'm not in the X-Men.
Didn't you learn the same lesson as Kitty Pryde? You've got to train every day for when you might need the training.
Yeah, I mean, that was a lesson.
If you're going to be an X-Man, you can't be slacking, okay?
I guess I'm too much of a slacker. The art was okay. It was very 80s. There was this, I can't even remember what issue it was in. This amazing, like, close-up frame of Storm, where they make her eyes, like, very big, and she looks like Magikarp, the Pokemon.
For Storm.
Oh my god.
It exists. I can find it for you guys.
Please find that and send me a picture. Oh okay. My god. Because
Gyarados.
I can't. I don't remember exactly that panel, but thinking back on the art, I can totally visualize that. Oh my god.
I mean, so that happened. And then we have some writing that's like, she smells like a woman, and you just, like, that, okay. She smells like a woman is something you would hear in an advertisement from, like, 1993 for some feminine hygiene product. Okay? So, I mean, this was, like, really 80s in a bad way in some ways. I feel like Days of Future Past, the two issues, did not convey the dystopian mutants are hated because they're different theme too well, because it was so short. Like, if we were able to expand this into maybe like 3 or 4 issues, give it a little more depth and a slightly more whole sense of resolution, I think that would have panned out really well. As it stands, I mean, I have to keep in mind that this was 1980, so this was a time in comics that I don't personally enjoy too much. I'll have to say average, 2.5.
Okay. I will go next because I don't want to go last, because I feel like David will say what I want to say. So I'm going to try and say it somewhat differently. You know, when I was reading this comic and when I finished reading this comic, I really wanted to make a bunch of comparisons to Dark Phoenix. Because it came after right after Dark Phoenix. I mean, it's the same kind of team build. It's still the X-Men. Like, it's an obvious comparison. But then I thought for a couple seconds more, and I was like, no, the one that this really reminds me of the most is the old-school Galactus comic. Like, the first showing of Galactus. Where you get that feeling like, wait, this guy, how did this character in fucking purple, tight, hot pants become like the world destroying menace of the entire Marvel universe? Like, and that story arc had the same feeling of like this quick resolution that in the end didn't really matter. Galactus came, built something on top of the Baxter building. Somehow some motherfucker went to the other side of the galaxy, picked up a nullifier, came back, and Galactus shit his pants and ran away, and then everything moved on. Like, I feel like this was the same kind of really quick, non-resolution story that, for some reason, is one of the greatest comics of all time. And I think it doesn't get that rank strictly because of itself for what it is. I think it gets that for the ideas that drive it. The idea of this dystopian future where things are really and truly fucked coming up in the Marvel Universe. The idea of Magneto winning and then it somehow transforming him into Professor X of the future, Magnus and not Magneto. I liked that a couple times people slipped up and called him Magnus and said, wait, no, Magneto. And so I think the idea for this world is really good. I just don't know why in the hell it was only 2 issues. It made it seem like it was really quick. The only person who kind of mattered was Kitty Pryde, but even she didn't remember it. And then we don't go back and see what happened to the future. We don't see whether it changed anything or not. Like, that would have been such a great moment to go back to the future and see... back to the future. To go back to 2013 and see, like, oh my god, they did all this and nothing worked. And see... Jesus, to have the last panel be just like Rachel Summers sitting there bawling her eyes out because she realized when Kate Pryde came back that it didn't work and all of her friends are actually dead and there's nothing to do about it now. There's straight up nothing they can do. Like... that would be crazy. That would be one of the best panels in comics I've read in a long. But there's none of that, you know. And I know that scene happens. You know that scene happens because they come back to this world, and it's like there's so much good stuff here that doesn't happen here. So it's like I want to give it so much credit for the idea behind it, but at the same time, it's just the idea behind it, not the actual writing that's in it. Even though I gotta say I think I like the writing better than Jen. I really liked a lot of moments where the little things, like the little slip-ups, the Magnus and Magneto, and I really liked the way Colossus was written. And as far as the art goes, I liked a lot of the details in 141 and 142, the stuff in the background, the small things that aren't necessarily immediately noticed. And it was a really cool-looking dystopia. I mean, it was a lot of just, like, boards on the floor and shit, but, you know, whatever, it worked for me. So, yeah, after all that rambling, I still haven't thought of a number in my head. 3. I'm going to go with 3.5. Yeah, 3.5. 3.5. Okay, yes. That's it.
All right.
All right. David, go.
All right. I actually wasn't going to go to that down that path, Andy.
Snap.
But, so you could have gone last. I'm going to give this a 3. So I think it was better than average. But I think it's better than average because it's a good like I said earlier, it's a good representation of what the X-Men are about. This is what they're, everything that Professor Xavier is doing is to prevent this. And so we get an example of, you know, we get an example of his failure. We see the repercussions of everything that happened, and we also learn that time travel doesn't really work that well. But yeah, I didn't like Janet, like you, Andy. I didn't really hate the writing. I thought it was okay. I think it was pretty typical for the time, and I think Chris Claremont does a really good job at telling the story. So I'll bump it up a little bit. But you know, it is a little bit disappointing in that. There's no consequences. Maybe they're not immediate. And if we kept reading the comic, we would see them later. But maybe I'm just too used to reading comics, you know, modern comics, and the way they're told now. And like I said earlier too, my first experience with this was the cartoon. And you know, although the cartoon is not that great, it's not like watching Batman the Animated Series or something, I thought that told the same story in a little bit of a better way. Although we get less of the dystopian future in that, it seemed more dystopian. It was even harder because, you know, like one of the other differences is that, you know, how the mutants just had to wear shirts that said M on them? In the cartoon version, they actually got tattoos on their face. That was an M.
Oh yeah, and that's why Cable has the M on his face.
Well, Bishop. I don't think
Cable. Bishop. Yeah, sorry, my bad.
So I mean, you guys, I agree with a lot of the things you guys said, but I do think this is an important comic in X-Men because in two issues you can get a good idea of what the whole thing is about. So yeah, I'm gonna give it a 3.
Okay. And you know what? While you were talking, I realized what I feel is missing from this compared to Dark Phoenix, right? Because Dark Phoenix, you get that whole story, and you're kind of like, okay, cool, whatever. That sucks, Jean Grey's dead. But then you get that weird existential issue with Phoenix in the white costume talking to Death. And it gives you this very different outside perspective on the story that's this neat existential commentary on death and existence and the necessity of something like the Phoenix, right? You get this outside of continuity commentary that's really, really great, and that makes the whole story come back around and gel in your mind when you put the comic book down. And that didn't exist here. Instead, we got Christmas Demon. That's what's missing in my head. I just needed that weird, or even like what was the Armor Wars one where you get the issue, like the 2 or 3 pages even of Tony Stark like swimming through circuitry and cables, you know? Just after a story like this, I feel like I need something far out like that to help me come at it in a different way. I think that's what was missing for me. So thank you for in some way making me think of that, David.
You're welcome. That was my intention.
So that wraps up Days of Future Past. Next week, we're going to read God Loves, Man Kills, because we're not done with the hefty stuff from X-Men, apparently. That's also written by Chris Claremont, because if you didn't know, he wrote X-Men for, like, I don't know, 50 years or some shit. Like, forever. Chris Claremont, and drawn by Brent Anderson. And that's actually a graphic novel all on its own. So it's a standalone. I don't know how many issues it is. I don't even think it is issues. Like, it wasn't even a miniseries. It was just straight up. It was
published as a graphic novel.
Yeah, here's just this graphic novel story, God Loves, Man Kills, with the Uncanny X-Men. And I think it's pretty much the same team that we have here. So anyway, that's what we're going to do next week. Until then, if you want more information, if I've thoroughly confused you on what the fuck God Loves, Man Kills is, because I didn't know either, because I researched poorly, you can get more information by going to our website, which is www.atomicpiratesupercast.com. And you can also ask us directly via email.
At atomicpoweredsupercast@gmail.com.
And you can also hit us up on the social medias.
Which is twitter.com/APSupercast or @APSupercast and facebook.com/AtomicPoweredSupercast. And that's actually wrong. It's facebook.com/APSupercast, right, Andy?
Yes, there you go. And as always, please, please subscribe to us on iTunes. All right. I think that's everything, right?
Yay.
Yeah.
Sick. Okay, everybody. Until next week. Goodbye.
Bye.
Meanwhile, I have to say, I have a fear. We watched the original trilogy of Star Wars while her friends were here, and she seemed mildly excited. And then I made her watch Star Trek The Next Generation, the first like episode or two, and she was really excited.
Wait, she'd never watched that before?
She'd never watched it before.
Really?
Awesome.
Wow.
If she liked the first if she liked the first couple episodes of Next Generation, she's going to really like it after you get through seasons
That's
1 and 2.
That's what I'm saying. Season 1 is like one of the worst seasons, and she's going to really like it, especially like the Locutus stuff. Like, oh my god. Yeah. She's going to shit herself. I can't wait to see the reaction.
You definitely have to watch that before you watch any of the other
She
series.
Says she likes Patrick Stewart.
Well, who because, doesn't?
I mean, I love
likes,
Next Generation.
And she likes Riker, of course.
I love Next Generation, but my favorite show is Deep Space Nine by a million
years. Yeah, see, mine's Voyager, though. I grew up on Voyager, so I gotta go with that one. But the point is, I'm afraid, because I'm an adamant Star Wars, I'm on that side of the fence, and I'm afraid I might be marrying a Trekkie.
Uh-oh.
You'll be all right.
You shouldn't look at me like that. You shouldn't look at me right now. Oh, my God. What the hell?
I love you. It's just, it's a classic nerd debate. What's the name of the movie, David? Fanboys?
Yes, Fanboys.
We need to watch that so she can understand.
Hey, I think your local video store has that.
Oh, I know my local video store has that. I've rented it from there before.
Oh, okay.